All right, folks. It is still morning. I was just told that I'm the only thing that stands between you and lunch. And that is why that I am standing up here instead of back there at the doorway. It's like that Old Testament guy that said that it wasn't possible, you know. Yep. That's right, and he was trampled to death, yeah, by people trying to get out to get to lunch.
It was for food then, too.
What'd you say?
It was for food then.
Oh, yeah, it was. Ah, yes. All right. Well, let's pray. Heavenly Father, God, I thank you that you have answers to help people who struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder. God, I pray that you give me wisdom as I speak and speak through me. And Lord, I thank you for doing so. And then God, I pray for people who struggle with this. It is widespread. I pray for the soldiers. I pray for the civilians, all of whom have problems that they just can't shake. God, I pray that you'd give us answers to help them with. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. My first experience with post-traumatic stress disorder came at an early age. I think I was 7, and my brother was 5, and my Aunt Charlotte called my mom up and asked if she could take us, my brother and I, on a date. She had a date with a fellow. It was for the opening of a movie at the Indiana Theater. The Indiana Theater in downtown Indianapolis was really one of those artsy kind of, looks like Egyptian, you know, Moroccan architecture theater. It was a big deal back then. And she was going to take us to this opening of the movie. And I can remember that, I forget what my mom dressed us up in, probably the best stuff we had, but my aunt arrived in her evening gown and her date had a tuxedo on. I remember that. I don't exactly know what our purpose was in being on the trip. And we took a cab, you know, a cab from where we lived to downtown Indianapolis and back. And the movie was Frankenstein. Yeah, Frankenstein. My brother and I spent the next years of our lives sleeping with our backs to the wall. Yes, I do not like horror movies at all. Not that anyone should. I don't see what the purpose is of sawing people's extremities off and listening to them howl and finding that entertaining. It just doesn't strike me that way. But anyway, you know, I can remember asking my mother later about that. And he says, "Mom, what were you thinking? You know, I was 7 years old, and you send me off to see Frankenstein." And she said, "Well, I didn't think it hurt you." So anyway, that is a rather mild experience with post-traumatic stress. People who struggle with post-traumatic stress disorders have a far greater burden than that. It affects servicemen and servicewomen who serve in combat and can't forget the things that they have seen or the routines that they've learned in order to avoid being killed. It's part of the lives of men and women who've been abused physically and emotionally and sexually in childhood and in adulthood. I can remember 2 children that I consulted on that were struggling with bad dreams and problems, and their parents had taken them, and I think they were like 10 and 8 or something like that, to see the movie The Passion of the Christ. You know, a well-meaning thing. I saw the movie. I own it, and I won't watch it. And the reason why I won't watch it is entirely too real. You know, it was well made, but far too real for a 10-year-old, far too real for an 8-year-old to comprehend what was happening. PTSD or PTS, the military people like to call it PTS. They don't want to call it a disorder. It's post-traumatic stress. And I try to abide by that. It's born from real experiences, like the friend that I'm staying with over in Sacramento. He was a helicopter mechanic on the USS Roosevelt during their Cuban Missile Crisis. And he said they were dropping nuclear depth charges into the Gulf of Mexico because it would take that to bust the hull on a Russian nuclear sub. Couldn't kill them with regular depth charges, so they were practicing dropping nuclear depth charges and had dropped them. He also told me that being on an aircraft carrier deck was and is probably one of the most dangerous workplaces one can ever be on. And the reason is because there's all kinds of moving things that can kill you. And the noise, there's just an amazing amount of noise. So they have pathways in which they are supposed to walk, prescribed places in which they are supposed to be. And he said on a given day that one of his friends, there were five of them up on the deck, and the one guy turned and went the wrong way and walked right into a propeller spinning on the airplane. And he said that the other remaining five guys were sprayed with this fellow, you know. And he said to this day that if you take a mister, you know, a bottle mister, and spray it in his face, he'll see that. He'll see it again. I have one friend who can't go in an MRI machine because she's claustrophobic, and it started when she was held down by a larger man and assaulted. Not everyone who sees and hears bad things or suffers them comes away with post-traumatic stress. And I think that's very important, because I suspect if we're going to help the ones who struggle, we need to know what was different. You know, why did you see this and it didn't affect you that way? Or why, when you saw it, it left you in the state that you're in? If we can figure that out, it can be of great help. I thought about what I ought to title this. I have down at different times, and I am working on writing about it. But I thought about titling it PTSD and the Sovereignty of God. But I thought I'd be misunderstood and criticized. But the truth of the matter is, for those individuals who find their way out of it, they generally find their way to God's sovereignty. Even if they don't exactly understand it or the doctrine of it, they find their way to it. So, well, the first thing we ought to do is get a working definition of what it is. It's a growing struggle. It grows out of a terrible event like rape, murder, combat, death, injury, natural disaster. There'll be all kinds of people in Houston and all kinds of people in South Florida and people in Puerto Rico who will struggle as a result of what has happened to them. And there are combat soldiers right now who will be in situations that will result in them struggling. It generally involves the really bad things in life that we all hope to avoid. You know, most of us aren't signing up to be a part of natural disasters. It can also come as a threat, the threat of death or physical injury. I was talking to one fellow who struggles with it, and he was on a flight line at I think at Kandahar, and they were being shot at, and nobody was hit, and he wasn't injured, but he struggles with nightmares about, you know, out on the runway working on the airplane and somebody up there shooting at them. And it has adversely affected his life. The threat is a lot like, you know, a haunted house at Halloween. Now, I should have known better, you know, it was when my daughter was in school down at Liberty University, and they wouldn't call it a haunted house. They call it something else, you know, a fright house or something like that. And so we went because there wasn't anything else to do in Lynchburg. And it's a burg anyway. Yeah. And we took my son, Jeff, who I think probably was maybe 5 or 6. Now, you would have thought I'd have just known better. I should have. So anyway, everything was going along fine until we get to this room in which there's this lady who has a boa constrictor around her neck, holding the tail and the head. Now, it was a corn snake, you know. Boa constrictors come in different sizes and shapes, and this one was one of the smaller ones. And everything was going pretty well until she leaned in with the snake towards Jeff. And at that point, he ran right up me to get away from it. And, you know, I am still waiting at this point to start receiving psychiatric bills for his care. So even the threat, as the guy on the flight line and as my son, can result in people having problems with post-traumatic stress. It's generally a situation where they can't do anything about it, and it comes with fear and helplessness and horror. It's It's the sense of helplessness that the soldier has who's sitting in the truck behind as he watches his men killed by an IED and can do absolutely nothing to stop it. It results in dreams and flashbacks and thoughts and feelings of the event, the woman who struggles being near men who took who look like the one who raped her, the old soldier who would not see my partner because he looked like the soldiers who had imprisoned him during the war. A good account that can give you a good idea of it is to read the book Unbroken. Zamprini. When he was back, he and the pilot who survived, they were back in Hollywood, in California, in Los Angeles, and they were out to eat dinner one evening, and pretty routine thing, both had their wives with them, and the waitress comes and puts a bowl of rice down in front of them, and the pilot went ballistic. You know, get this out of here. And it had to do with, you know, that was what little food they got in the prisoner of war camp was rice. You know, not particularly logical, but it was how he responded. And that folks who struggle with PTS hold in common. Just like my friend getting water sprayed in his face and seeing the guy walk into the propeller again. The same kind of thing. They respond like it's happening again and may include delusions, hallucinations, and flashbacks. The response is like my Marine friend who went hunting. He was back from Vietnam, and he decided to go out rabbit hunting. Probably not a great strategy for him, but he was out in southern Indiana in a cornfield, walking along the fence row. That's what you do. You walk along the fence row and hope to kick the rabbit up, and then you shoot it and take it home, skin it, and eat it. It's really pretty good stuff, actually. And there was a woods up ahead, and another hunter came up out of the woods and shot his gun. And before my friend knew it, he was down on one knee and had a bead on the guy and came to himself and, broke the breech open and took the bullets out of the shotgun and went home and never went hunting again. Kept the gun. It's still underneath his bed, but wouldn't put himself back into that kind of setting again. Then when they're in a situation that's like the event, they may react like they are still there, and they will avoid situations that remind them of it. Soldiers will act like they're in combat. Assault victims will act like they're back in the situation again. As one soldier told me, I've lectured about this for a good while now, and one fellow came up afterwards and said, you know, it's a completely different way of thinking. You know, when you and I go into church, what are we thinking about? Well, we're hoping that we like the music, you know. It depends on what age you are, you know. And some of you will understand that, but most of you look semi-conscious right this minute. And then we think about the sermon, don't we? You know, what's pastor going to talk about? Will I find something in it that will be useful to me or helpful to me? We think like that. He said that when he walks in and sits down in church, he's plotting his exit strategy. You know, he's looking around the building and determining how he's going to get out. Then they may not remember the events or parts of them. What's the pathophysiology? Why does this happen? Well, quite frankly, we don't know. The medical cause of post-traumatic stress is uncertain. MRI scanning and PET scanning are not nearly as helpful as we'd hoped they would be. We don't have any tests which are absolutely diagnostic at this time, although lots of research is going on. There is a confounding variable in all of it, and that is traumatic brain injury. Most of the soldiers who come back from combat have probably had something big and explosive go off too close to them. and may bounce their head off of something, and so they may struggle not only with the post-traumatic stress issue, but they may also have traumatic brain injury problems as a result of injuries that they had while they were in the field. How do we treat it in medicine? Well, I can tell you that multiple medications have been used. I spent probably about 5 years doing overnight shifts at the VA hospital in Marion, taking care of people on the psych ward and in the nursing home, and then seeing folks who would come into their sort of emergency, actual, more like an urgent care room, room there. And I can tell you that as I looked through their charts, I was impressed with the amazing array of medications that were being given to young men who came back and who were dealing with post-traumatic stress. Now, the unfortunate thing about it is that none of it really seems to work very well. The current recommendation is for a SSRI antidepressant, usually Zoloft, because it's generic and inexpensive, and then cognitive behavioral therapy. That's what they're generally doing. Of all the medications that I have found that I've seen used and have prescribed and found useful, the one that I think is most useful is Prazosin. It's a old alpha adrenergic anti-hypertensive drug. And what it does that's useful is it helps with their dreams and nightmares. I've had some individuals who have been struggling mightily with waking up in the middle of the night 3 or 4 times, and which means they're not getting any normal sleep, and who will struggle with getting up and vomiting and things like that, and on taking Prazosin when they go to bed at night helps them. Not wake up with the dreams as much. So they get more normal sleep, and they don't seem to get as disconnected from the situation and the setting that they're in. So that I think of all, and it's not an antidepressant. It's not an anti-anxiety drug. What it does is probably affects the way that your adrenal glands respond to threats, and suppresses the epinephrine output that you would normally have, that makes your heart beat fast, puts you into the fight or flight setting. So multiple medications, the current recommendations, antidepressants and cognitive behavioral therapy. They also attempt to do what they call desensitization. One of the more popular ones is eye movement desensitization reprogramming. It has to do with talking to people about their adverse experiences while you have them follow your finger. I do not know how it works. I don't think anybody exactly knows how it works, other than they think it might have something to do with putting new information in different spots in your brain. Another variant of it is tapping. I've seen that talked about, where people tap on their knees. I had a fellow who was involved in an auto accident, one of those kind of deals where you're sitting at the stoplight and the guy's coming right at you and you cannot, there's no place to go. You are there, hit head on. Didn't hurt him too badly, but he became nearly non-functional. Driving became an amazing challenge to him. And he said he went to a therapist and she had him tap on his knees while they talked about it, and he got better. So, I can't tell you what the mechanism is. I just know that it is used in some quarters to help people who struggle. Important recommendations with regard to dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder is avoiding isolation, which we'll talk about in a moment. Going back to work when you get home from the field. And avoiding alcohol and drugs. Isolation, not having a job, not having a purpose, and then alcohol and drugs all make this situation worse. Those are obvious but important things. Then, how do the patients describe this? What do the soldiers, sailors, and Marines say? Well, the problems that these individuals face when they return include things like substance abuse, isolation. If you are in regular Army and you're deployed, when you come back, you go back to the base and you're there and you're with your Corps. and your Corps supports you. If you are National Guard or reservist, you go back home, and there may very well be not very much there to help support you at all. And so those fellows can end up being somewhat isolated, which is not at all good. There is a loss of purpose to the individual who's been sent home and perhaps given a medical discharge from the armed forces because of symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and a sense of brokenness. As one soldier told me, "I'm broken in a way that cannot be fixed." That was his comment about it. When you take somebody who spent their whole life training to be a soldier, and then, you know, maybe within a day, suddenly they are not able to do it anymore. What you've done is you've taken a whole life's purpose away from them. And that, of and by itself, is devastating. It's sort of like if anybody had a job in here that they liked and someone came in and said, "You can't do it anymore, and here's the reason why," you would struggle with that and not have any other reason just than that. So, you know, the sense of brokenness and the loss of purpose. They struggle with flashbacks and dreams and sleep disturbances. My Marine friend said that the way he dealt with his sleep problems was initially when he got home from Vietnam, he would come home and in the evening he would just sit down and start drinking until he passed out. And he would do that every night and did it until his father said, "You can't do that anymore." His father had fought in World War II with Patton and could see what was going on. And so he said, "No, you can't do this anymore. And I have a job for you tomorrow." he went and found him work. So then they have problems with hypervigilance and hyperreactivity and startle responses. My Marine friend said that there was a day when he was walking down the hallway in the house, and his sister decided to jump out of a doorway and say boo or something to him. And he said, "Before I knew it, I had her halfway up the wall by her throat, up against holding her up in the air up against the wall." And that was what he was taught. You know, these are things that he was taught, that if he did them when he was supposed to, he would live. If he didn't do them, he might die. And of course, his sister never jumped out of a door at him again. These individuals suffer with shame and guilt. Generally, their shame and guilt is that they came home and their friends did not. They also struggle with anger. The fellows who came back from Vietnam were poorly treated. It was a national disgrace the way the men who returned from Vietnam were treated by people in this nation. The thing that compounded is then once it was all over with, you know, we were told that we lost the war over there. The truth of the matter is we had the enemy on the run. And we paid dearly in order to get that done. And then the politicians all got together and gave it all away. And then allowed millions of Cambodian people to be murdered just because we left and left in a way that allowed it to happen. And so then you had lots of guys back here who had watched their buddies die and they're going, "For what?" You know, when we went to war in Vietnam, it was to do what? Anybody here old enough to remember what the reason why we were supposed to have gone? Yes. And so what is Vietnam now? Yes. And we could have saved 50,000 lives and who knows how many billions of dollars. That's what the average soldier who fought in that war sometimes sits down and thinks, and it makes them angry. And you can say that the same thing could be percolating right now in the minds of people who've watched their friends die in Iraq. You know, we had subdued that country, and then we pulled out and left it. And you know, the question is why did my buddies have to die in order to leave this in this quite a mess? So anyway, and I'm not here to, you know, preaching about whether the war was right or wrong or any of that. What I'm saying is, what are the guys who had to fight it and came home after it was over, sit down and think about in the evening when they think about the time that they spent? Well, it leaves them angry. And then they struggle with fear for their safety. You know, once you've been in a situation where your life has been threatened and anything similar happens, you struggle with that. And then they struggle with depression. And generally, it's over loss of purpose. And, maybe the most important thing we can do for soldiers who return from a service overseas is to make sure that they have a job. There's an organization in St. Louis, Missouri right now, and it's a return to service, I think. I think that's what the name of the organization is. And what they do is they have 6 month internships for guys who've come back and don't have work, and they put them doing a real job, usually in some community service thing, but it's not, it's not a volunteer kind of situation. They get a stipend and they actually have duties that they are supposed to perform. And, helping them make the transition back from being in military service to serving people here in the United States. What do civilians struggle with? They struggle with almost all the same kinds of things. They struggle with fear and worry and anger and depression and loss of purpose. A big issue is victim status. You can spend the rest of your life being a victim of whatever it was that happened to you. And I don't say that in an unkind way. I just mean that's their state. They are stuck in that status. They struggle with sleep disturbances and flashbacks and reactivity. I had an individual that I gave. She put her on prazosin, and she went from being unable to function at times to doing very well at this point because it interrupted her nightmares. And left her in a state where she could respond biblically to the struggles and the fears that she had. Once she got all wrapped up in a nightmare, then it was difficult to get her to think in a way that was very biblically productive. They struggle with relationships and marital problems and sexual dysfunction. Individuals who've been raped or sexually abused will struggle mightily with this. Trying to have a normal relationship with another individual is difficult for them. They struggle with eating disorders, substance abuse, and shame and guilt. And the question is, can any of this be avoided? That's the question. All right. So now we have the definition. And who are we going to pick that could have had post-traumatic stress disorder but didn't? Yeah. I want to caution everyone as we start to consider Joseph in this situation, who's a classically good example of somebody who shoulda, but didn't, that you be careful how you apply this to folks who have struggled with post-traumatic stress. There's several different ways you can interpret Joseph's situation. And in some of them, you will you end up being like the disciples in John 9, who walked by the guy who was blind and born blind from birth, and they said, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" I've always thought about that and said, the guy wasn't deaf. their comment wasn't particularly helpful to him. So, as we look at individuals who struggle with this, we should be very careful about how we approach it and what we say about it, because we don't want to add more load to their burden. We want to see what we can do from Scripture that will give them grace to deal with the struggle. So, people who struggle with post-traumatic stress, many of them got into the situation that they're in through no fault of their own. They weren't looking to end up in this situation, but they are. And we should keep that in mind as we deal with them. So what would we say about Joseph in order not to make him a burden? Well, we would say about Joseph that he was a young man who was of good character. That he did nothing to cause his problems. In the account you can find between Genesis 37 through 50, when I help folks who are dealing with things like this, I have them read Genesis 37 through 50. and I ask them three questions that I want them to answer when they come back. And the first question is your life worse than Joseph's? And I can say that I haven't had anybody come back and tell me their life was worse than Joseph's. And I've said that a lot around the country. And someone told me the story of an individual that I have actually met and helped take care of. And I can say wholeheartedly that her life was worse than Joseph's. So, you know, there are no universal answers to questions like this. But most of the people will tell you that either their life is just as bad, but they won't tell you that it was worse. Because Joseph's life is pretty difficult, wasn't it? You know, what did he do? Well, he had a dream that God gave him, by the way. And what did he do about it? Well, he went and told his brothers. What did his brothers think? Well, they didn't particularly like the idea that the sun and the moon and the 11 stars would bow down to him. They didn't think that was a good idea in the least. And they hated him for it. Hated him so much that on a given day, they decided they were going to kill him. You know, and you know, you can look at Joseph, and I've listened to some people try to preach this and say that the reason why Joseph got in trouble was because he was a spoiled brat. And I smile when I hear that, and I say, well, can you show me that in the text? If you can show me that in the text, I'll be happy to agree with you, but I don't see it there. All I see is that Joseph was the one out of his brothers. It would have been 10, I think, at that point. No, the other one was born. I think Benjamin was alive. So out of all his brothers and him, which was the only one that Jacob actually could trust? It was Joseph. Yeah, and all you got to do is keep reading, and they show you why. You know, there was not a good person amongst them. You know, Reuben, who tried to save Joseph, eventually sleeps with his father's concubine or wife, and then all the rest of them were complicit in wanting to murder their brothers. You know, and so they were just living out their character, which was fairly miserable. And the reason why Jacob preferred Joseph was because he could trust him, and the reason why he sent him to go check on his brothers because he was the one that he could trust. And as he comes, what do they say? Lo, the dreamer comes, and they start plotting about how they're going to kill him. And, you know, so he arrives at an inopportune time. It was lunchtime. And so they decide that they'll throw him in a pit, and then they'll sit down and eat lunch. This is the kind of people that you're dealing with. These are cold-hearted individuals. And while they're eating their lunch, a caravan of Ishmaelites comes up, and they're going, oh, yes, there's profit to be made in this. Yeah, you know, it's like the Ferengi in Star Trek. There's no profit in it. Yes, if we kill him, what good is that going to do us? We can just sell him. And so they do. They sell him into slavery. And, you know, and one of the accounts says that he was begging them not to. All the time it was going on. So that's the first step on the line. And you would think, my goodness, this guy grew up in a dysfunctional family, wouldn't you? He probably has all kinds of multiple leather diagnoses that can go along with him. And so the next thing is that he gets sold to Potiphar. And how does he respond? Well, you know, he gets up off his backside and he goes to work. And he works very hard at it. And pretty quickly he becomes the head steward, you know, the number one, the guy who was running Potiphar's household. And you would think that things are lightening up here and the music ought to come up and the credits should be rolling and Joseph's life is not going to be too bad. And I always point out, always keep in mind that Joseph was, of all things, most certainly a sinner. Period. Joseph, this isn't Saint Joseph. You know, Joseph is a sinner, and I, without doubt, he sinned regularly. And this isn't about how good Joseph was. This is about God's grace, isn't it? Because the fact that Joseph is running the prison is due to God stacking the deck. All along the line, God is stacking the deck and seeing to it that Joseph is going to end up in a specific place at a specific time, all right? So don't interpret this as Joseph just being a really good guy who worked really hard and climbed the corporate ladder as being the number one steward at Potiphar's house. That wasn't how it worked. And things, of course, take a turn for the worse pretty quickly. What happens to poor Joseph? He becomes the first victim, biblically recorded victim of sexual harassment in the workplace. Oh, yes. Yeah, this is right. First they want to kill him. Then they sell him into slavery, just like human trafficking is today. And then Potiphar's wife decides that he's a looker. Yes. And she pursues him day after day. And day after day, he tells her no and no and no and no and no. How can I sin against God? How can I sin against my master? You know, you're the only thing that the master doesn't let me run in this household. Why would I want to sin against him? And of course, she won't take no for an answer. And eventually on a given day, she catches him in an inopportune place, grabs his cloak, rips it off of him, and he jumps out a window, I think, or he finds an exit. And then she hangs onto his clothes and tells Potiphar that the Hebrew slave that you hired tried to rape me, which infuriates Potiphar. And what does Potiphar do with him? He has him thrown in prison. So do you think that Potiphar actually thought that Joseph tried to rape his wife? Think about this. Yeah, if he were the normal guy and in Egypt and he really thought that that Joseph was hitting on his wife, what would he have done to him? Yeah, he'd have started chopping him to pieces from the toes up and thrown him to the fish in the Nile. That's what he would have done with him. So I really think that Potiphar was really angry because, and I doubt that it was Mrs. Potiphar's first trip to the rodeo, you know, and I think he was really angry because what was happening was that he was losing the best household steward he'd ever had. You know, his house hadn't run this well ever, and she has to mess this up. So that's just my speculation. You don't have to take it as biblical or absolute interpretation. But anyway, so what happens to him then? He gets thrown in prison. And by the grace of God, he gets thrown in prison. And what does he do? He just gets up off his backside and goes back to work. And God blesses it. Again, the deck is stacked. He's going to end up running the prison for a reason. And pretty soon the baker and the butler show up. You know that story. The butler had the dream. The baker had the dream. The baker gets hanged. The butler goes back to work with the message. Would you please tell Pharaoh that I'm down here and I didn't do anything to belong here? And of course, what does the butler do? Forgets him. Yeah. Conveniently forgets him until it was time. Wasn't time yet. And then on a given day, it was time. And Pharaoh has the dream. You know, God arranging all the way along the way. You know, this is God's grace acting in Joseph's life to move him from point A to point B. And on a given day, Pharaoh has a dream, and within a couple of hours, Joseph goes from being the head steward in the jail to being the prime minister of Egypt. Think about that for a minute. How could you get that done? How can a Jewish boy get to be the prime minister of Egypt? Try doing that today. Not going to happen, isn't it? No, not outside of divine intervention, not outside of God's grace. And that was exactly what was happening then. So what can you say about Joseph? You could say that he was a good man, and when confronted with difficult choices, he chose to do good, and as a result, a good God blessed his socks off. You could do that. And if you do that, you will add to the burden of people who struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder. And the reason why you will add to their burden is because they will say what? I am not good. Yeah, they will. And then they'll also say, I don't make good choices all the time. I'm not like Joseph. Quite on the other hand, if Joseph is simply a sinner being moved from point A to point D by God's grace, perhaps they can identify with that. Joseph is an amazing example of the grace of God working in the life of a sinful man to do an amazing thing. That's what Joseph is all about. So Joseph now is the prime minister of Egypt. And how does he come to understand all that happened to him? Well, yes, that's exactly right. His brothers do show up, and he takes care of them. He sells them grain and puts them through all their paces, and and then when it's later, And Jacob dies. The brothers come to him and give them what I think is a real cock and bull story about how Dad told us to remind you that when he was dead, you were supposed to take care of us. Yeah, sure he did. You know, because what they were expecting was what would have normally happened in almost every place in the Middle East. You know, Dad's dead, so are you. I mean, there were going to be 11 heads in a pile someplace. Why? Because, well, they tried to kill him. They sold him into slavery. He spent the last 20 years of his life paying for their misdeed. And instead, what does he say? He tells us the precursor to Romans 8, 28 and 29. You meant it for evil. God meant it for good. Yeah, that's right. Joseph had figured it out. I would tell you this, though. It took Joseph 20 years to figure it out. And he wasn't saying you're meaning this for evil when they threw him in the pit and God means it for good. He didn't say that until much later. Now tell me, what got Joseph through all that? I'm not going to change the slide because it's the answer's there. What got him through 20 years worth of all that stuff thereabouts? Anybody want to make a guess?
He understood the sovereignty of God. He believed.
Well, that's right, he did. What promise that he had given him? What? Exactly right. It was the dream. Yeah, he hadn't seen it yet. What do his brothers do on the first day? They show up wanting to buy food, and they are in the hall where the prime minister of Egypt is going to come and hear their petition, and he walks in. What do? They all get down on their faces before him, just like the dream. And, you know, I look at that and I go, Joseph was pretty bulletproof to that point. Yeah, why? Because God said it was going to happen, and it hadn't happened yet. Yes, do we have any promises like that in Scripture? Oh, yeah, we do. Yes, I always like what it says in, what is it, 1 John chapter 3? Let me find it here. 1 John chapter 3. It says, see how great a love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called the children of God, and such we are. For this reason, the world doesn't know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now are we the children of God, and it has not yet appeared what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him because we shall see him as he is. That is the promise that we have, which is just as good as Joseph's, actually. I've always said that to be like Jesus when Christ returns means that I'm going to be 34 and have a few extra scars. Yeah, that's right. And I know that doesn't mean much to some of you, but for all of us who've been a lot past 34 for a long time, it's kind of important. Yes. So the dream got him through. Now, what helpful things are there to address with your individual who is struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder? Joseph came to understand the sovereignty of God in his life, and he embraced it. And eventually, the counselee who finds their way out of post-traumatic stress will have to understand sovereignty and embrace it. They're going to have to embrace Romans 8, 28 and 29. All things work together for good. Do you know what that word means in Greek, all, if you parse it out and look at it very carefully? Do you know what it means? All. That's exactly what it means. Yeah, every last bit of it, good, bad, or indifferent. You know, I don't know what it is about us, but it seems like that bad things seem to get our attention more. That's what Lewis said. Pain is God's megaphone. It's his way of catching our attention. Not many of us fall down on our faces before God and ask him what went wrong when we get that $10,000 bonus from work. No, we're just doing the happy dance to the bank. But when things aren't going well, yes, when things aren't going well, we find our way, don't we? Yes. So, coming to understand the why of it, embracing it, that's a big deal for individuals who struggle. I always keep in mind that it takes time. I'll probably say more about that in a minute. The helpful things to know and address is one is that God has a plan for their situation. It's the John 11 thing. I don't know. Have I talked about John 11 in here? After I go through two or three different places, I start forgetting where I told the jokes, you know. So it's that four-part sermon in John 11. Jesus knew about Lazarus. He had a plan for Lazarus. He cared about Lazarus, and he acted on Lazarus's behalf. you know, that chapter is, I think, immensely important to people who are struggling with whatever, for whatever reason, whatever bad thing happened in their life. Just like Jesus knew about Martha and Mary and Lazarus, Jesus knows about you. He knows about your struggle, and that Jesus certainly had a plan for Lazarus, and he certainly has a plan for you, and that he cares. That's why Jesus wept in the garden. Why in the world did Jesus weep in the garden? He was going to raise Lazarus in 5 minutes. And, you know, the reason, yes, that's right. The reason why he wept was because he cared. He cared that Lazarus had to suffer, that Mary and Martha had to suffer as well. He cares about your sufferings, the individual whose life has been upended by post-traumatic stress things. And then finally, he will act on your behalf. As Christ acted on Lazarus and Martha and Mary's behalf, he intends to act on our behalf. He will. So John 11, a great place to take them. The next place I think they need to go is Romans, is to redemption. You know, it becomes a matter of Romans 10, most of the people who struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder in the military are unsaved. Now you can run with that in exactly the wrong direction if you want to, but wait a second. I didn't say that if you're saved, you're not going to get post-traumatic stress disorder if somebody blows your friends up right in front of your face, did I? I didn't say that. What I'm saying is that most of the people in the military are unsaved. Yeah, the vast majority of them are. And if they are going to profit from biblical counseling to help them with post-traumatic stress, they need to know the Lord. They really do. They need to know about the grace of God that will save them, and then the grace of God that God intends to give them to live through the struggle that they are currently facing. We not only are saved by grace, we live by grace. The same kind of grace that carried Joseph from his home to being prime minister of Egypt. That same kind of grace is the kind of grace that carries us along through life right now. Then they need a return to purpose and motive. Individuals who are struggling with post-traumatic stress need to have a purpose in life. And that purpose needs to be, I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. You know, it becomes the primary purpose, the one that will allow them to put everything else in some kind of order or some kind of context. My purpose is not to recover from post-traumatic stress, although, you know, it sort of is, but that isn't my goal in life. My goal in life is through dealing with it is to glorify God in the way that I respond to it. So a return to purpose, whether therefore you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Then they need to learn to trust. People who are struggle with post-traumatic stress often have been in situations which rip trust right out of their lexicon of life. You know, they lose the ability to trust anybody that is like the individual that harmed them, or the individuals that harmed them, or the situation that they were in. And I always tell people that I think the best chapter I know of to learn about trust in the New Testament is Romans 8. For people who are struggling, it starts in verse 1 and says that we're not condemned. In verse 12, it tells us we're not obligated to live according to the flesh. In verse 15, it tells us that we haven't been given a spirit of slavery leading to fear again. In verse 16, it tells us we're his children. In verse 18, it says when we suffer, it will be worth it in eternity. In verse 26, it tells us that the Holy Spirit is currently praying for us right now. He is interceding for us, and for things that we're not even smart enough to know that we need yet, the Holy Spirit is currently engaged in interceding for us. In verses 28 and 29, it says that God intends to work out even the most difficult problem that we face so that it will be for our good and for his glory. And then finally, in verses 31 through 39, he tells us that he will never abandon us. We are never alone. We are never on our own, not as believers. Then they need to move on. My friend who came back from Vietnam said that his life improved measurably when he started reading his Bible again. He was a believer before he went, walking far from the Lord. And he said he got to it when he got to Philippians chapter 3. And it said, forgetting the things which were behind. Someone asked him, why didn't you get stuck in this? And he said, well, I just decided to move on. You know, and it was Philippians 3. That's where he saw it. Forgetting the things which are behind and reaching forward to the things for the prize of the high calling of Jesus Christ. The and then time. Everyone gets their own 42 chapters. I've always said that John, the Gospel of John, is my favorite book in the Bible. The Book of Job. I'm currently reading it. You know, it's. I've gotten there every year. I get to Job, and I know I'm going to be there for 42 chapters. And I've always said, it only took Paul 4 chapters to tell us about joy. You know, in Philippians, why does it have to take 42 chapters to tell us about suffering? Anyway, and that's pretty short-sighted on my part, I guess. And I have come to understand that everything we know about suffering that's important, we know because of Job, and that Job never knew. You know, Job didn't know about the argument between God and Satan. He wasn't privy to any of that. But he lived through it for our benefit. For our benefit. And when I realized that, I repented in sackcloth and ashes. But anyway, the and what was the answer that Job finally got to? When Job gets to the end, what is the answer that he comes away with? You know, to the cosmic, you know, why about what all this is all about. It's in 42:2, and it's, you are all powerful and you can do as you please. You know, Job found his way in chapter 42 to sovereignty. You know, you are all powerful. You can do as you please. And from that, I've always said, everybody gets their own 42 chapters. You know, post-traumatic stress is not a 6-week event. And some people will take a considerable amount of time in it, but they should make progress over time, as Job did. All right, then, fear, the drill. This drill, y'all have your pens and paper ready to write? Because I'm going to give you the propeller drill. It's not in your notes. This is a college-level course. Come on. You can write. Are you ready? This is what my friend who saw the guy walk into the propeller did. My friend eventually was saved. He came to know Christ while he was in Cuba. Not in Cuba, at Key West. He went to a church in Key West, it was in Key West. And he came to know the Lord there and dealt with post-traumatic stress that he had developed because of his experiences in the military. And his way of dealing with the guy walking into the propeller was, because he would see it, and when he saw it, it was very emotionally distressing. You know, it would just tear him up. And he said, the first thing he would say was, this vision is not real. So write this down. This vision is not real. And then he would say, the second thing he would say is, this vision cannot hurt me. This vision is not real. The vision cannot hurt me. Third thing he would say is, whatever God has for me in life from this point forward will be for my good and his glory. And then he would recite 1 John 4:18. Perfect love casts out fear. So, the vision is not real. The vision can't hurt me. Whatever God has for me in this life from this point forward will be for my good and God's glory. And 1 John 4:18, perfect love casts out fear. He said he did it a lot at the first. And as time went on and he would do the drill, the emotional content began to seep away from it. And now he would tell you that if you spray water in his face, he'll see it, but it doesn't tear him up anymore. And what he was doing was very insightful. And it's what I do with all kinds of people in counseling, is that you're retraining your brain You're retraining your brain to respond biblically to a difficult situation that you had trained your brain to respond in a non-biblical way. You know, and I think that's at the base of most of what the EMDR, the eye movement desensitization and the tapping and all that kind of stuff is. You put a different thought in your head associated with whatever it is the flashback is. And I find that it's very useful. Then they also need to deal with worry. Don't have time to speak about it today. You've had to lecture about it. But the worry I deal with out of Philippians chapter 4. 1 through 10. Rumination is a big thing. They need to learn about forgiveness, as Louis Zamperini learned. Yeah. They need to learn how to forgive individuals who harmed them. I think the best resource on forgiveness is From Forgiven to Forgiving. It's by Adams. I would commend that to your attention. If you don't own it and haven't read it, you should buy it and read it. It gives you a logical order of how to forgive people. I tell folks to forgive people when they ask. And the ones that haven't asked, you turn them over in a Romans 12 sense and let God deal with them. From Forgiven to Forgiving. And then you have to return them to service. Back to service, serving others. Christian service. Christian service is find an individual, a person. It's not washing the windows at church or cutting grass. Those are good things, but this isn't what we're talking about. It is serving a person. And you find a person who's worse off than you are, a person who cannot serve you or help themselves, and they can't be a relative. An old doctor wrote this out once. It's just great stuff. And the reason why it can't be a relative is because there's always secondary gain to be had by doing things for your mother-in-law. Anyway, some of you will get that. It can't be a relative. It's a person. You do it 1 to 2 hours a week. You can take nothing from them, and they can't pay you. And you're going to do this the rest of your life. It is that is amazingly helpful to people who are struggling with depression. And what does it do for them? Yeah. Gets their nose out of their own belly button. Yeah, that's right. I can see and serve someone who is worse off than I am. And so I quit thinking about myself and I start thinking about them. So Christian service. I used to do it with ladies who would come to counseling. They lived up on the northeast side of Indianapolis. They all lived in houses that were worth, you know, real estate differences are, you know, in Indiana, we get lots better houses than you do for a lot less money. But let's say they live in a house worth $1.5 million here in North Creek. And their husbands were busy and they were all dysphoric because they weren't paying enough attention to them. So I would send them down to Wheeler Mission in Indianapolis and to work in the Mother's Club, where all the women had 2 or 3 children, some of them by different men. Most of them didn't have all their teeth. They were living in a homeless shelter. And it was amazing the attitudes that they came back with. You know, as they served those women, they realized that they weren't nearly as bad off as they thought they were. Yes, and their husband wasn't nearly as neglectful as they could see other people being neglected. All right, so that's what I do with people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, just exactly those things. Now, we have a minute or two. Do you have a question? Yes, right back there.
Could you reiterate the 3 questions you have regarding...
All right, the 3 questions that I ask people when they read Joseph 1 is your life worse than Joseph's? And 2 is, what did Joseph do every time he got knocked down? And 3, what was God up to in all of it? That's the 3rd question. What was God up to in all of it? Yes.
Also liked your Romans 8 summary as it kind of relates to what we're talking about. I sure would love to have that.
It's not in your notes, is it? No. So do you want me to say the whole thing again? You can't write that fast. You have a phone. You can come up here and take a picture of it in a minute.
Okay.
All right. Solve that problem. Yes.
You mentioned under the help
person retrain their brain?
Yep.
Is it retraining their brain or is it retraining their mind?
Well, I view mind and brain sort of synonymously.
That's one thing I've really kind of wrestled with. The brain is obviously the organ, the mind is the thinking. Addresses the thinking, not the organ.
You know, I haven't really thought a lot about the question that you're asking. If you want to send me an email, I'll think about it and answer you. That would probably be a better thing. You're welcome. Yes, one more question and then it's lunchtime.
With the story of Joseph, do you ever have a concern that you might be providing false hope to the people that everything's going to turn out and be pretty at hand, or when you can joke as well, or do you just kind of focus them on heaven, or like as the end game?
You know, I really don't have a big worry about that. I just use the story. Most of the people that I see who are struggling with things like this, if they pursue biblical counseling and do work on their situation will be demonstrably better. It doesn't mean that they're all going to be prime minister of Egypt, but it does mean that they can find their way to be in a position to glorify God with their life. So I guess that's how I would answer that. But I appreciate your observation because I think it is very important to be very careful how you apply that story to other people. You know, I try to emphasize the fact that Joseph was a sinner and he was moved from point A to point B by God, always by God's grace, not based on his performance. Although his performance was important, it wasn't why things were working out the way they were.